It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The 2015-2016 Supreme Court session has come to a close. One of the issues the justices looked at on the final day of the term is abortion clinic restrictions in Texas. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a closer look at that decision with Susan Fritchie, senior staff attorney at the Women's Law Project here in Western Pennsylvania. But first, we're looking at the other significant high court decisions handed down this session involving everything from federal corruption to immigration to limiting gun rights for domestic abusers. Our legal contributor, Pitt Law Professor David Harris, joins us to talk about these rulings and how they will impact our lives. He is also the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, it's good to be with you again.
And you can join the conversation with a comment or a question by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Again, the number 412-246-2002. David Harris, let's begin by having you talk about what you consider to be the most important event of the term, which you say wasn't an opinion. I'll bet I know what this is, but I'll let you run with it.
Oh, it's definitely the departure and death of Justice Scalia. This has colored pretty much everything from that day forward. Of course, we're all aware that there is a protracted delay, shall we say, in the nomination and confirmation process. President Obama has made a nomination. The Senate won't hold any hearings. But the effect on the court itself has been deep and profound. There have been four tie votes, 4-4. In which the court, in some significant cases, has basically said we can't come to a decision. We are tied 4-4, and that means that the decision below stands as it is. It usually only applies in the circuit where it was decided if it came from a federal court of appeals. And that is just limiting the Supreme Court's ability to get some of these issues resolved and to move forward. And there's no precedential value in these tie votes. And you see the court struggling even in other cases. I think the one that really comes to mind is the Obamacare birth control case, the one that bears Bishop Zubik's name, in fact, in which the court, it's the most bizarre thing I've ever read. Justice Kennedy kind of saying, here, take this back, lower courts, and see if you can come up with something better. And we think the party should kind of compromise. I mean,
happens if they don't? What happens?
Well, then the case will come right back up to the Supreme Court. And perhaps then the court will be at a full complement of 9 justices and it can be resolved one way or the other.
So yes, we saw a few 4-4 ties, which keeps the laws at status quo.
Basically, yes.
So it certainly, the death of Antonin Scalia certainly seemed to impact the decision on President Obama's deferred action for parents of American citizens and lawful permanent residence plan,
right,
under which undocumented parents of U.S. citizens would not get deported. And this was an issue that came up, in fact, on the show yesterday. That also got a 4-4 tie,
yes,
vote, affirming the lower court decision, which held that the plan was unconstitutional. Now, who knows how it would have gone if Antonin Scalia was still alive, but that was one of those things that was profoundly impacted, as you indicated.
Absolutely. Chances are very good that Justice Scalia would have joined a majority to strike down the president's plan. As it is, we have a lower court decision, a district court decision that remains in place. Not a full decision, I should note. It was a preliminary injunction put in place by a district judge, and he refused to stay his order that the whole plan was unconstitutional and was enjoined, and a federal appeals court refused to stay that injunction as well. So for all intents and purposes, that immigration plan is dead for the remainder of this presidential term, and this whole issue will turn over again for next Supreme Court term and certainly for the next president.
And one of the things about the Supreme Court, and I'm sure this is one of those things you really love about the high court, David, is that it's not like Congress, where it's so often so predictable. We can assume logically that Scalia would have would have sided with those who were against the president's immigration plan. But we don't know for sure, as was the case with the Obamacare decision and the way Justice Roberts went. I think that was, what, 4 years ago?
Right, right.
You just don't know.
Right. It's a good point. There is a certain degree of unpredictability here. We can't always tell how things will come out. I know that you'll be talking to Sue Fritchie in your second segment regarding the abortion case. People were holding their breath on that one. I mean, they didn't know how it would come out. So we just there is a certain level at which we can't predict how any individual justice will see a case.
Although it is interesting that in that decision, when it came to the Texas abortion law, all of the women on the high court were against it, and the dissenters on the decision, the three, were all men. So that may be, you know, you can look at that maybe and say, if you're wondering how people are going to go on a certain issue, those who are more profoundly impacted by it might have a different feeling than others.
Perhaps so.
In the University of Texas versus Fisher case, the University of Texas affirmative action plan was upheld. Why did the justices decide that this does not violate the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause?
Well, affirmative action in higher education has been the subject of a number of different Supreme Court cases going all the way back to the 70s. And most recently, the case that was in the Supreme Court was also titled University of Texas versus Fisher, just like the one yesterday. So yesterday was Fisher number two. And
right.
The question here was whether taking race into consideration in any way could be considered constitutional, because the University of Texas makes it one factor among many others in deciding who to admit. The plaintiff in the case, a young white woman, said that she was denied admission because of her race. But in kind of a surprise, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority opinion and joined other justices in saying that taking race into consideration in this limited way does not violate the Equal Protection Clause. And it was surprising because he's never joined an opinion on the court in which affirmative action in higher education is supported. He's always been against it. So now what we have is an issue that is basically put to rest as long as the university under scrutiny is using it as a non-decisive limited factor. They can look at race or ethnic origin.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Pitt Law Professor David Harris, host of the podcast Criminal Injustice and a regular. Going on, what, 5 years now? You've been with us.
And happy to do it.
And happy to have you, because how else would we be able to parse through these decisions and fully understand them? If there's something, though, that you are concerned about or uncertain of as you try to sift through all of the information that is coming out that went into these decisions, and this has been certainly a very eventful term for the Supreme Court. That's what we're talking about today. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. And I'm specifically looking at those of you who are thinking to yourself, how did they arrive at that decision? What are they taking into consideration? That doesn't make any sense to me. This is the man who can help you figure it all out. David Harris, 412-246-2002. Another major decision reached just yesterday involved the public corruption case of Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, who was prosecuted for using his office to benefit a contributor and benefactor. Now, this is something that if there is any decision that's a head scratcher for people, I would think this might very well be it. The court threw out his conviction. What did the court base this decision on? And you probably should give some background on this case. What did he do for a particular benefactor here?
Sure, sure.
That led to this case.
Well, Governor McDonnell had a supporter, a gentleman who had a supplement company, And this gentleman wanted to get meetings with particular state officials. He wanted to have the governor sort of imprimatur through having an official event at the governor's mansion. In exchange, this gentleman made some gifts to the governor, allowed him the use of certain items, including a sports car and some other things. So it was a kind of personal, low-level corruption that you and I would recognize as something smells bad here. The federal government went after him under a statute that basically says that the governor was committing corrupt action by using official actions, governor's actions, public official actions in service of and for those gifts and so forth. And what the Supreme Court did was to dramatically narrow the meaning of this idea of official action. So according to the Supreme Court, it can't be the things that are kind of ancillary to being a public official, like having a party in the governor's mansion. It must be official actions. So if the governor is vetoing a bill that is has an impact on the guy's business, that would be one thing. But just introducing him to somebody or helping him make an appointment with a regulator or having a party, those things aren't official action. It has to really be part of the governor's duties as governor in order to qualify as corruption under the statute. Now, none of this says that the state of Virginia or any other state can't have other laws that would prosecute corruption in other ways.
But this was a federal case.
A lot of government corruption is prosecuted on the federal level by U.S. attorneys and the attorney general. So it's a significant matter, and it will shield effectively a lot of state-level government corruption from federal oversight.
And here's what what you're saying makes complete sense, but here's what I think that people may not get about this decision. And we'll get into what Justice Roberts wrote in a moment, but The governor in this case, he would never have been approached if he wasn't the governor. Serving in this official capacity.
Exactly. And so that it does seem to make it completely logical and obvious. This guy's approaching him and giving him gifts and showering him with special things because he's the governor, because he can do things the governor can do and use his influence. What we're dealing with here is the construction of a statute. This is one of the things courts do. And on the federal level, it's what the Supreme Court is set up to do. It's one of its major jobs. And they are simply saying, look, in terms of what the statute says and what Congress intended, this has gone way too far. If the Congress wants to prosecute more things, they got to go back to the drawing board, give us another statute.
So, again, the justices are saying, in this case, the governor did not take official action, so what he did was okay. And I guess the question...
Not okay, just not against that law.
Understandable. But again, someone might look at this and say, such as the lawyers for former Pennsylvania Congressman Chaka Fattah, who recently resigned after being convicted on charges of racketeering, bribery, et cetera. I believe he resigned just last week. They're reviewing this decision now, this McConnell decision, for potential implications for their client. What might those be, David?
Well, if he's prosecuted under this statute, the same statute, and I don't know if he was or not, that may make a difference. But remember that Fattah was also prosecuted under the racketeering laws. Those are totally different.
Okay.
And for bribery, which is an entirely different sort of conduct. Quid pro quo, you give me this and I will do that. A bribery statute, outright acts of bribery, violate a different law. So those convictions are going to be safe.
Is this decision going to make it harder to prosecute
officials? No doubt, because it was widely used as a way to prosecute public officials on the federal level.
Also yesterday, the High Court upheld the broad reach of a federal law that bans people convicted of domestic violence from owning guns.
That's right.
Is there any surprise there?
I think it was a little surprising because there's been so much activity domestically and politically about gun rights. It put a spotlight on it. But more to the point, The people who have taken an absolutist position on the Second Amendment often miss the fact that in the Supreme Court's recent cases, I go back to Heller in 2008, which basically said you have a Second Amendment right to defend yourself and carry arms personally. They miss the fact that the court said, no, there can be regulation. There can be reasonable regulation. And here, what the Congress had said was, if you're convicted of an act of domestic violence, that is something that makes you a much greater risk for having a weapon. Therefore, we will prohibit that kind of possession, that kind of person from possessing a weapon. And the court said, no, that's perfectly reasonable in terms of it being a regulation. It does not infringe on the Second Amendment. The other surprising thing was a kind of back and forth between a couple of the justices about some very basic criminal law concepts, such as mens rea, such as recklessness, and those kinds of concepts. In the basic first semester criminal law course, I teach all that stuff. And this is going to be a showcase opinion for that course from this point on. And it's highly unusual. We have more cases that we teach in that course from the English courts than we do from the U.S. Supreme Court, because pretty much our criminal law in this country is made by states and state courts and state law. So the Supreme Court weighing into these kinds of matters is really unusual, and I think it will give, certainly going to be a field day for my students and I.
Very interesting. And I'm sure your students, if they're listening, are looking forward to that that's this fall, right?
It'll be this fall.
Okay, so just a couple of months away, kids. What about the police search and seizure case, Utah versus Streif?
Streif, yes.
Extending and strengthening police power under the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, this is a case that has really set off the talk in my particular area of law, criminal procedure and police regulation. Here is a case in which a police officer was observing a house, and he had some anonymous information that there might be drug sales happening in that house. He observed a man just walk out of the house. He had no information about the man, nothing about what had happened inside the house, but nevertheless, he decides to stop and detain the man. Now, right there, that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. You need at least reasonable, fact-based suspicion to do that, let alone probable cause. And the state of Utah conceded that he didn't have any. What happened next was that the police officer detained the man and then checked him for warrants. And when a warrant came up in the system for some traffic case, the police officer then arrested and searched the man and found some contraband on him, some drugs. Now, the question was, could those drugs be used in court to convict the man when the stop that led to the discovery of those drugs was definitely, concededly illegal?
You would think absolutely not.
Absolutely not. That's the way it's always been. The Utah's courts all said, no, can't use the evidence. Well, the Supreme Court said, nah, it's okay. Use the evidence. Why? Well, that warrant was out there. The police officer would inevitably have discovered the warrant anyway, and the warrant would give probable cause, and therefore the whole thing kind of works backward to wash away the bad search. I think this is one of the worst decisions that the court made this entire term. And I think they're going to regret this for a long time, because this is with the millions and millions of warrants that circulate out there every day in the United States in court systems all over the country. Lots of people have warrants out there for petty stuff, failing to pay a ticket, failing to come to court for this or that. These are not trivial things, but it's common.
It's not felonies.
It's not felonies. No, it has nothing to do with those things. And this is going to be the way that police will operate going forward. They'll stop anybody they want, anytime they want, and they'll be able to get rid of any taint on the evidence simply by finding a warrant.
So it flies in the face of one of those really American things that we have in this country that prevents unlawful search and seizure.
It flies directly in the face of it. And I don't see how they could justify this. I am dumbfounded, frankly, that Stephen Breyer went for this. He was part of the majority. I can't understand that given his prior jurisprudence on this. Justice Kennedy, I think, is maybe equally disappointing in the majority.
Yeah, Breyer was, in fact, the justice who wrote the decision in the Texas abortion case, which we'll get into in the next segment. But that's about as animated as I've ever seen you about a decision.
I got to say, Paul, this is going to have consequences for millions of people. Racial profiling, it's coming at you. I mean, I saw this happen once.
Maybe the worst time in our history.
Yeah,
for that.
Yeah. This happened once before in a case in 1996 called Wren versus the United States that involved traffic stops. And I remembering the alarm bells in my head going off then. And sure enough, things got much, much worse as far as racial profiling on highways. This will be a power that will be begging for abuse. I don't mean to say every police officer will do it. Not by a long shot, but it's out there to be used and abused anytime a police officer wants to do it.
We need to hustle through these last two things. The court rejected a challenge to the traditional interpretation of one person, one vote rule that has stood for decades. So what would a contrary decision have meant?
A contrary decision would have shifted political power into rural areas from larger cities because it would have only counted registered voters. And we have no way to count registered voters, believe it or not. We use a census that is not based on that. So it would have shifted the one person, one vote rule quite radically and would have changed things in a lot of places in the United States.
Last but not least, what about the challenge to fair share union costs for non-members of public employee unions who benefit by virtue of union contracts? We've talked about this before.
Yes, we have. And this was one of those 4-4 ties that meant that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion that upheld the union fair share contributions stands in the Ninth Circuit with no opinion of precedential value from the court.
David Harris has been our guest. He's our legal contributor, a law professor at Pitt, distinguished professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, and also the host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. David, as always, great thanks.
My pleasure, Paul. Thanks.
Coming up, we'll zero in on the high court's decision to strike down elements of that Texas abortion law. What could this mean for Pennsylvania? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.